country, from your relatives, and from your father's house to the land which I will show you. This sentence is a record of one of the most important moments in history. 4,000 years ago, a word from the Lord began salvation's story, identifying a people for God's name and preparing a family for the birth of Messiah. But Abram didn't know any of that at the time he was called. What is important for us and what the scriptures call out when it looks when the New Testament and later in the chapters of the Old Testament look back toward Abraham, they look at his faith, his willingness to trust God before he knew what would happen, before he understood what the outcome would be, before he knew the plan that God had initiated. It's his faith that we are called to learn from, to be inspired by, to choose ourselves in our time and place. And the 11th chapter of Hebrews gives an extended discussion of Abraham's faith. We're going to actually spend 3 weeks, this one and two more, on that part of chapter 11. You may know we're working our way through the 11th chapter of Hebrews and its great stories. And for 3 weeks, we're going to actually consider what is taught to us about Abraham. But before we get to Hebrews 11, I want to interrupt myself and ask us to give some attention to a modern-day pair of wanderers, if you will. Abraham and Sarah, in the guise of Travis and Gay Gray, are going to leave here. God has called them to a new place. They don't know exactly what's going to happen to them when they get there. They're going with hearts of ministry and obedience, and they're beginning a new adventure. Most of you know that the Grays have helped us begin a ministry to folks in recovery that has grown and flourished, and for which we're very grateful. And even folks who don't identify themselves as recovery people, many of us have gotten involved in that ministry and have been changed by it as well. So we have a lot to be thankful for looking back. And I'd like to invite the Grays to come up here, as well as Ed Woodall and Andy Burnham, who are going to pray for them. Sending people from here who were trained here, raised here, grew up here to some other place is a long-standing tradition of PBC. So as hard as this is in some ways, it's something that we ought to be excited about as well. We're excited about it. Andy, would you lead us in prayer?
Thanks, Eric.
Ed was actually an emotional young man in his day. He just hid it better in those days than he does now. So, thank you. So, the task before us now is to consider the faith of Abraham. Not just his outcomes, not just his story, not just his influence and sort of, you know, historic significance, but the choices he made along the way to trust God. We're to emulate the kind of faith that we find. And again, our task, or our text rather, is the 11th chapter of Hebrews, beginning in verse 8, 8 through 12, and the comments made here about Abraham and Sarah and their lives and so on are hopefully will give us insight as to the adventure, you know, the exciting response to the Word of God that we might have as we hear this story. So this text, 8 to 12, divides into three sections, pretty obviously by the phrase by faith. It occurs in verse 8, verse 9, and verse 11. And the first section has to do with hearing and obeying. The second section, beginning in verse 9, has to do with life intents. And the final section has to do with the peculiar timing of God. So let me read, beginning in verse 8. By faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Jacob, with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. For he was looking for a city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. By faith, even Sarah herself received ability to conceive, even beyond the proper time of life, since she considered him faithful who had promised. Therefore there was born, even of one man, and him as good as dead at that, as many descendants as the stars of the heaven in number, and innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. So as I said, we'll take the three sections in order. The first section is verse 8. By faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance, and he went out not knowing where he was going. We encounter this story, and it's the first lesson for us has to do with hearing and obeying God. God's entrance into our experience, God's breaking through of kind of our ordinary circle of events and decisions and so on, will always bring change. God doesn't show up just to sort of keep us in the same place we've been. He comes to make a difference. He invites us to follow, calls on us to follow. And he doesn't explain what the journey will be. He doesn't give us a map ahead of time. We begin the world of change in following God, not knowing how it'll turn out. And that's exactly, of course, Abraham's story. So how does the business of hearing and obeying work? It's sometimes difficult to hear God. Maybe our experience is that. It's difficult to know exactly what it is that he's saying, what particular thing he's saying. Sometimes the difficulty is in obeying God, and I think once we consider them properly, we'll realize that the two always go together. That nobody really hears God well unless they are predisposed to obey him. Unless we've already decided to go where he sends us, we won't hear clearly where he says we should go. And in our obedience, we become better and better at hearing what he says. It reinforces our ability to receive from him what he would give us. Hearing and obeying go together. But not everyone has the same assignment, do they? Not everyone should spend this weekend in the capital of Iran, at great risk to themselves and on an adventure of that sort. Not everyone is going to be sent to the capital of Texas, for that matter, as the next stage in their journey. Some people are assigned to stay put. Some people are given an assignment of reaching out in a new place that's local, some at a distance. Some are called to take new risks in relationships that already exist. Some are called to begin new relationships. God has an adventure for us. And the question is, will we listen and will we obey and will we follow and will we receive life from him in that process? Abraham was called to leave Mesopotamia. You remember we talked about last week about Noah. Noah was called to stay in one place for decade after decade and be true to the witness that he was. He wished he could leave, most likely, but was required to stay. God has a different journey for each of us. And our hope is to be those who hear better and obey more fully and have the excitement of living lives that are pleasing to God. So how does one hear what God says? How do we sort of discern the call that he makes to us, the word that he has for us? I remember in my earliest days as a Christian trying to apply sort of the life skills that I had learned before my Christian life, before I had faith in Christ, trying to apply those same life skills to living a Christian life. I wanted to please the people around me. And I thought, well, I've just got a new circle of people around me to please. I was in this circle over there. Now I'm in this Christian circle here. And the skills that I'd learned were, how do I best make people like me and sort of find out what they expect and meet their expectations? Before I was a Christian, I had a certain sense of what my duties were, what my responsibilities were, and I wanted to discharge my responsibilities. So becoming a Christian, I had a new set of responsibilities, a new set of duties, but I sort of lived my life as if doing your duty was the main thing. And over time, the thing I think that God has taught me most is to give up the old skill set, is to not expect that he will speak to me as if pleasing people and doing one's duty and so on are the main things in life, But he speaks most often, I would suggest, through the burden of love that he places on our hearts. Love communicated, his love to us, is the first thing. That when he calls us to a place or to a response, when he opens a door that he wants us to go through, it will have about it his love for us. We will sense that we are more connected to the heart of God. We will find that he is nearer to us and dearer to us and more communicative of his pleasure in us, his approval of us. That discovering the will of God, if we were to use that phrase, will always have in it his joy, his approval, his embrace. That if we feel a kind of awful responsibility that no one can ever possibly discharge, we're probably not listening very well. That discovering God's will have in it the experience of his love. And secondly, it will be a burden of love. He will give us concern for people, concern for injustice, concern for hopelessness, concern for the weak. He will give us a heart for the truth, a burden to speak the truth where truth has not been spoken. Somehow or other, he will grant to us a concern, his love for us first, flowering in our love for the things he loves. So if we are asking the question, what is God's call for me? What is the adventure I should be on? The heart of the answer to that question will be, what has God given you a heart for, given you love for? What matters to you because it matters to him? And in that way, I think we can discover the next place he has for us, the door that he's opened for us, and so on. We hear and obey, and the more we hear and obey, the better we hear, the more we obey, and these two reinforce themselves. Abraham heard God speak, and he left on a journey. God is speaking to us, has a place for us, an opportunity for us, gifts for us. And there is nothing better in the world than making that discovery and acting on it. The second section begins in verse 9, and it's the problem of living in tents. Verse 9. By faith, Abraham lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of the same promise. For he was looking for the city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. Now, verse 10 introduces a subject that we're actually going to take up next week. Dwelling as an alien in the land of promise, living in tents in a place you've been given. That's the problem that we're presented with here. And one of the things it does in verse 10 is make us long for the city that has foundations. It makes us look forward to what's not here yet. We're excited about a future that is not here yet. And that's actually the whole topic of next week's discussion. But it does a second thing. Living in tents in the promised land also is about the experience right now, our experience right now. What is true of people who have been given a gift? God said to Abraham and to Sarah and to their offspring that he, the Lord maker of everything, had granted them a deed to a particular place on earth. If anyone's voice has the right to give land, to pass on property to someone, it is the maker of it all. He had given this land to Abraham and Sarah and to their children. But in their lifetime, they were never allowed to build anything. They always dwelled where they were supposed to in their own land, but they always lived in tents. Impermanent structures, wandering from place to place. They were Bedouins in the place that God had promised to them. What are we supposed to learn in such a life? We're living the same kind of life. Promises that we can claim, but a life that remains impermanent. We have been given everything we need, but not everything we want. What do we observe and learn? What do we conclude from making the observation about tent living that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and that those families experienced? My wife Leslie's father, some of you will remember Fred, he frequently visited here, and He used to tell the experience of an experience in his childhood. He grew up in Oakland, and he had one sister, and the two of them, two children, mom and dad, would go at the beginning of the summer every year to Yosemite. And his dad would build this campsite. It had, you know, tents and maybe other little temporary structures alongside the Merced River, and he would set it up for the whole summer. And there were, you know, hundreds of other families did the same thing, and each family, you would come back year after year, and the kids would grow up together. And the dad would go home to Oakland at the end of every weekend and work at his work, and then on the weekends he would come up to Yosemite. And so the kids grew up spending the whole summer in Yosemite in tents. And they'd run around the valley floor. It was on the valley floor, right in the middle of everything. Of course, that's, you know, ancient history now. No life like that can possibly exist anymore. But that was their experience. And he talked about how wonderful it was. You'd ride bikes, run around, sail on the river, make friends. Great summer in Yosemite. Now, again, there's two ways to look at that. You could say, you know, it's too bad I don't own Yosemite. What would really be cool if Yosemite was mine and nobody else's and I could live in the Awani. You know, I could build this really cool big structure and I could live there and it'd be my permanent home and I would have everything I want. You could say that. Or you could say it's pretty cool to spend a summer in Yosemite. It's a great gift, even though that it's temporary, even though it's going to end at some point, even though there's some dislocation in the family and everything's not perfect, it still is a life that's filled with value and joy and purpose. And I think that's the point the writer of Hebrews is making in verse 9. Even though we don't have everything we want, we don't have everything we will have, we are intended to long for something that is not here yet, even that, though that is all true, what we have been given to do is worth doing. The lives we live now in temporary quarters, the relationships that we know aren't going to be exactly the same forever, and relationships always have some kind of loss and heartbreak to them. Even the best families grow and change over time, and the old ways change, and you can't hold everything in place forever. Even though that's true, it's still worth loving people. It's still worth using the gifts God's given us. It's still worth speaking truth. I spent a few days with Dan and Judy Van Eldren a couple weeks ago. And many of you also know the Van Eldrens, strong contributors to the life of this body. And they were they had a baby with them. And they were trying to count how many foster children they have had in their home. And they think it's 45. They're not absolutely sure. So this baby, named Jesse, is probably the 45th foster child they have had. He's about 4 months old now. They got him when he was from the hospital, you know, as he was born. And so, you know, I was staying in their home for a few days, and the baby was there, of course. And we were reflecting one night about the business of loving foster children. And I realized, talking to them, that the most difficult thing is not the inconvenience of a baby. Babies are inconvenient. Babies keep you up at night. Babies need their diapers changed. Babies restrict what you can do. Babies kind of require you to live life on their schedule, not yours. But that is not the most difficult thing, the inconvenience of a baby. I realized in talking to them is that you fall in love with these children. And as I said, they've had 45. I think the shortest duration is 24 hours. They had one or two babies just overnight. Two of the foster children have now become their children, adopted by them and are their children and will be the rest of their lives. And they've had everything in between in terms of length of stay. But after 4 months, you watch them with Jesse and you realize they have set themselves up to get their heart broken. And because the foster system is what it is, the most likely outcome for Jesse is not necessarily the best possible outcome. Kids that get in the foster system usually have a lot of chaos in their families, and it's not, you can't always predict they're going to end up in a good place. And so we were talking about some of this one evening, and you know, I realized the question is it worth loving someone that you can't keep? You know, is it worth taking the risk to give your life away, even knowing there's going to be some heartbreak afterwards? And you don't know if you'll, how connected, if any at all, you'll be with the child in the future. And the answer is yes. We're living in tents. It's, the things are going to change. the life we experience right now is going to be taken from us in some way. The tent flaps will come loose. The rain will get in. The wind will blow. The world is not the way it ought to be. But is it worth investing ourselves with truth God gives us to speak and love God gives us to share and fellowship that isn't going to be perfect and building families that have chaos and difficulty? And is it worth throwing ourselves into this life? And the answer is yes, because God's in it. It's never going to stop being impermanent in this life, but it is going to be increasingly filled with God's presence. And I think that's kind of the heart of this second section of our text. They lived in tents. But they lived in tents because God had directed them to. They were in the place they ought to be, serving the one they ought to serve. And He will take the choices we make and weave them into a beautiful tapestry. He will take the obedience we offer and make something of it that's eternal. He will build on choices we make in ways that we'll never see and couldn't possibly understand to accomplish things that we will not live long enough to know about. But because God is at work, because it's His choice for us, it's worth living to the full, even though we have to live in tents. The world won't satisfy us completely. Our marriages will be less than we wish they were sometimes. Our children will grow up and grow and move on and have lives that are kind of different than we might have imagined them, perhaps. Our elderly parents will grow more feeble, and the people we love, even the church we're part of, churches change, communities change. We live in tents. The world will never completely satisfy us, but it's really cool to be able to live in Yosemite for the summer. And that's the life God gives us, that we can throw ourselves into the place we are now because He's here with us. Because He is making something of it. The third section of our text is verses 11 and 12. By faith, even Sarah herself received ability to conceive, even beyond the proper time of life, since she considered Him faithful who had promised. Therefore, there was born even of one man, and him as good as dead at that, as many descendants as the stars of heaven in number, and innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. The folk tale, the common folk tale in our culture is that things ought to happen predictably. I think every culture has the same folk tale. They have different stages and expectations. But the idea is, as a child, certain things ought to happen in your life. And then, you know, as a young child, a certain thing. And then you go to grade school and you have whatever experience you're supposed to have there. And you know, you have little league tryouts whenever you are the age to have little league tryouts, and then that, you know, moves on, and you do this thing and that thing, and you go to junior high and high school, and after you go to high school, you go to college, and then you get a job, and then you get married, and then you have children, and there's this trajectory of timing that we're taught to expect. And it turns out in no person's life is the trajectory exactly the way it ought to be. There's always something that goes wrong. There's always something that surprises us. Things get out of order. They don't happen at the right time. We think we're postponing relationships because we want to have a job right in place and do well and so on, have our career before we have a relationship. But then the relationship comes along at the wrong time, or we're ready for the relationship and there's none to be had. Or we think that our job is progressing so that we're going to be promoted to the next level and we get fired. Or We think health is sort of a constant and we can draw on good health later in life, and health is not a constant and things go sideways. And over again, we realize that life is, the timing of events in our life do not conform to our expectations. And in spades, Abraham and Sarah had the experience of things being out of whack as far as timing goes. The promise made to Abraham and his wife is they would have a child, and they would have a child of their own from their bodies both, born to them, and that child would be the founder of a great nation. And there was no child. And there was no child. And there was no child. And they tried to intervene and bring it about other ways, and they disobeyed, and their life got out of whack in various ways, they trying to trust God, they couldn't trust God, and eventually they had a child. But babies are supposed to come before menopause. In the natural trajectory of things, you're supposed to have your children before you go through menopause. That God's timing was that discombobulated in their circumstance. And the point is, God has the right to change our expectations, to break the pattern. In fact, we will learn the most. We will learn the most about ourselves and about God and about life when things go wrong. We think we've achieved a high level of competency in something. We're really good at things, and we realize that we take a step from, say, the area where we work or study into family life, and we're completely incompetent in family life. And we sort of think we've grown up and we can do stuff and we're good at things, and all of a sudden you're put in a situation and you're not good at all. And the point is, God meets us at times when on occasions when He disappoints us and breaks the pattern, and the timing is off, and we learn that His ways are not our ways, but His ways are better, and that He can be trusted. Even beyond the proper time of life, even when it was impossible, God kept His promises, and Abraham and Sarah learned that He could be trusted in every way. Life is supposed to be an adventure. You come reading the first 11 chapters of the Bible, and you realize that sort of the stage has been set, and then you come to chapter 12. And chapter 12, beginning in verse 1 of chapter 12 of Genesis, is the story of it's the great story. It's salvation's story. It's the story of an adventure that began with one family in Mesopotamia, ordinary people in an ordinary place in a pagan world, and God said, "Follow me." And they followed, and they were changed by faith, and the world was changed. And their faith is held before us. Our lives are supposed to be an adventure. And God has something for us. And He will speak the open door, the path to follow. He will speak that word to us by love, mostly. His love for us, making us love something. Giving us a concern that this matters to me because it matters to God. And that will be the path for us to follow. We're going to live in tents all our lives. This world is not our home. It is not ultimately going to satisfy, but it is fully worth living. It ought to be filled with excitement. We have an enormous amount to be grateful for. We have a lot to be excited about. We have work to do and people to know and joy to experience, and it's worth living this life, even though it's not the end of the story. And finally, God's ways are not our ways. His timing, particularly the breaking of patterns and expectations, are the times when we will encounter Him most fully. I want to conclude by reading from a blog. Children, I think, have a sheet, some of them here, that has Karen McCormack's picture on the front of it, on our children's bulletin. And Karen is a very gifted writer. I commend her blog to you. I hope we have it in the bulletin, the note there. If not, you can get it from the office. But Karen and John, again, kind of active at the heart of the life of this church, had a child, had their own daughter, and adopted a second child, Emma, from Russia. Emma's 3 years old. They just went overseas to get her and returned, and literally on the day they returned, Karen had some illness, went to have it checked out, and discovered she has leukemia. And it is very serious business on a lot of counts. And this child, who hoped she now had a mother and may not have a mother, and mom's not home, and she's staying in the hospital, and it's, you know, there's kind of heartbreak and wondering what God's doing that fills that story on about every level. But I want to conclude by reading something Karen wrote. This is from a few days ago. And it ends with three verses from the book of Lamentations. And when I get to that part, I'm going to ask us to stand, and that will be our concluding note for the morning. But here's what Karen has written. As John and I have struggled with the news of my prognosis and the length of my treatment, it is hard to understand God's plans for the long term. But what I prayed for last night was ability to live in the now. We have too many what-ifs in the months ahead. We need to focus on each day and each week as it comes. What I do know is that God is good. He has met me and my family in countless moments in the last few weeks, and I have faith that He will continue to do so. Please stand, and we'll read the conclusion of her entry in the blog as our concluding word this morning. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed, for His compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is Your faithfulness. I say to myself, the Lord is my portion. Therefore, I will wait for Him. Amen. Please remain standing and we'll sing together.